Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, I share ideas and strategies. I talk about what worked for me, but also those big epic fails that I've made along the way. And I also interview experts. And that's what today's podcast episode is all about. It's me interviewing an expert who truly knows a lot about the creative process. Grace Hawthorne is the creator and founder of Paperpunk, a new creativity toy and tool for kids ages 6 to 99 plus. She's also a respected adjunct professor at Stanford University's Hasso Plattner Institute of Design, known as the D School. Hawthorne teaches courses on creativity and innovation, which led to a decade-long creativity study there. Hawthorne has been featured in esteemed publications like Scientific American and Wired magazine. Additionally, her artwork has been showcased in national museums, including the Smithsonian Cooper Hewitt Design Museum. And she has a phenomenal book that I really enjoyed. It's a short read. It's one of the great Stanford D School books in this series. I really loved it, called Make Possibilities Happen. So in this episode, we talk about all kinds of things related to creativity, to design, and to what that means for us as educators as we empower our students to be creators and makers in their everyday lives and to prepare them for the future. So without further ado, here's the podcast. All right, I have with us here Grace Hawthorne, and she has some excellent thoughts on creativity. And one of the goals of this podcast is for us to explore, what does it mean to have a creative classroom? What does it mean to empower students in their creative work? And I was really struck by just in reading your book, the notion of the bias toward action, of making creativity a reality, the whole concept of everyone can be creative. I found myself at times challenged in a good way. Most of the time I found myself nodding in agreement, but more importantly than that, I found myself thinking, oh, that's a strategy I want to use. Oh, that's an idea I want to check out. And so we'll be getting into the book here in a little bit, but first I would love for you to tell folks a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I like to speak in bullet points, sometimes like a ball machine. Perfect. So just raise your hand and wave wildly. If you're like, that made no sense. I'm cool with that. A little background on me, if I were to give you stats, I was an art major from Berkeley, and being a daughter of immigrants, my brother, older brother, was not a doctor, engineer, or lawyer. Mm-hmm. So he pursued filmmaking. So I took the brunt of it and I got a CPA. Those are the worst 3 years of my life, but it gave me a great foundation to business or industry, which kind of pervades everything in our lives, right? I also have an MFA and an MBA, and I'm a serial entrepreneur. I think inspired by my parents, so I design products that are sold in mass markets. I've sold over 3 million of my products on the shelves. I've started and sold a magazine. I've written 2 books, and I have 20 million other things on my to-do list that I can't wait to tackle in my lifetime. And this book is kind of a midlife capstone report in some ways, because it really embodies 30 years in the entrepreneurial trenches, 15 years in the classroom, and 10 years of a scientific research project done at Stanford in conjunction with the D School and the School of Med. So it really just kind of smashes all of that together. Mm-hmm. And that is this book, Make Possibilities Happen.
Yes. And so it's interesting. I want to dive into the book. You shared your own experience in being an immigrant and being an entrepreneur and having that background. And, when I taught middle school in the past, most of my students were either immigrants or children of immigrants. And so they were either first or second generation. And one of the things that I began to realize about our world is just how fast it's changing, just how adaptable students will need to be. And really realizing, even if they don't become entrepreneurs, they will have to have an entrepreneurial mindset. They'll have to be self-starters. They'll have to be self-directed. They'll have to be self-managers. They're going to have to take initiative. They're going to have to be creative. And I'm curious, when you think about your own background, what about those experiences shaped that entrepreneurial mindset that you developed?
That's a really good question. And it's something I actually often think about. I'm a parent. I have two kids, one's 22 and one's 18. So I've kind of been through all the phases and cycles, and I'm still in it, obviously, because my kids are both in college. And I wonder if it's like nature or nurture, right? This idea of initiative and resilience, right? Like, how do you teach that? How do you initiate that? And it's so funny because I was just talking to somebody earlier today. And while as a child, you spend a significant amount of your time in school, in a classroom, I do honestly believe that a majority of your child's or a child's education really starts in the home and comes from the home. And it comes from, and that's in, it's a little kind of a paradox when I say that, because it's like my parents were never home. So you're thinking like, yeah. Okay, it's not like they're there like, Grace, this is how you do something. But it's more like modeling. I feel like my parents had an unflappable, unfailing work ethic. And that's ingrained in me because of that. And then the second thing I would say that was largely influential is they were never around. So my brother and I, we were extremely self-sufficient at a very early age, because they literally got home at 8:30. That was dinner time for us growing up. And I didn't get to like do soccer team because my parents weren't around to drive us. So I do feel like we were left to our own devices. And I'm not saying everything turned out like picture perfect, but there's a lot of, I want to say, experiences that I collected in my childhood from just being left alone. But I do feel like that might be part of our generation.
Like, I think so.
My, like the latchkey generation, like my kids are in the helicopter parent generation. I don't know.
I definitely see that. It's really interesting to me in terms of myself choosing to take a lot of creative risks. You know, same, not same thing exactly, but being entrepreneurial, starting, you know, my own business, starting a podcast, starting content, you know, doing all of these different things. I find it really interesting. My kids are 18, 17, or almost 19, 17 and 14. So the oldest is about to turn 19. And it is really interesting because when I think of what I wanted for myself, that's on some level what I want for my kids. I want them to develop that mindset. I want them to take creative risks. But also, like, it's a different perspective as a parent where I have to check myself and go, I want this level of stability that they aren't necessarily inclined toward in a good way. And it's really hard for me to step away from that. And like in this podcast before, I've talked about the notion that the ladders become a maze. The maze terrifies me because it's unpredictable on some level, right? For them, it excites them. The notion of an unpredictable world is somewhat exciting. That's hard for me. And so I'm curious, when you think about students needing to be adaptable, how do you help adults, whether it's parents, teachers, how do you get them to embrace that idea of students taking creative risks, putting themselves out there, navigating that unpredictable maze?
It's so interesting to hear you compare a ladder to a maze, because those two things seem seemingly irreconcilable, but, so I feel like there's two parts to what you're asking. And the first one is, like, when you say your kids are excited about the unknown, that's a wonderful attribute and ability to possess, which is, and it's actually an ability that D School teaches, which is navigating ambiguity. In fact, there's a book titled Navigating Ambiguity that's part of the same guidebook series that my book is a part of. And think about that, like, none of us have a crystal ball, like as an adult, as a kid, right? Everything just unfolds. And like, if we had a crystal ball, like our, like we would know exactly what to do because we would know what was going to be happening next. Right.
Yeah.
And I think as a child, like, or as a young person, being excited by that, that is the posture and the outlook and the POV point of view that you want your child and students to have. And that's something that as adults, I feel like we're not semi-conditioned out of, but we have, as a child, like most children don't have to pay the rent, right? Like we have to pay the rent. Like we're supporting, and that comes with real responsibilities that like technically you're supposed to be free of as a child. Like you're not worrying about where the mortgage or whatever the situation is. And I think that when we have real responsibilities, we tend to play it safer because we want to make sure that we're able to provide and that tomorrow will happen in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
Can somehow let that live next to a framework that is forward thinking and positive, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, to get, I don't know, like self-developmental, you know, about it, but it's like, it doesn't happen to you, it happens for you. And we actually do a framing exercise as part of a navigating section in my course, Creative Gym. And we have students write out all the things that they feel tension around or things that they feel like anxious or fear around. And then, for example, one is like, I'm about to graduate and I have no idea what I'm going to do. And it freaks me out. And we have them reframe it. Like, how can you look at that in an exciting, to your point, way? I'm so excited about all the opportunities I get to pick from. And it's really just a practice or an exercise of perspective. Mm-hmm. And not really, I mean, that's part like of the, to make what's standing between you and your possibilities is starting and finishing. And you absolutely have to have the ability to see. And part of seeing is kind of where you're looking and how you're looking at what's ahead. So I don't know if that answers your question, but.
No, it does. And it has me thinking about the role of fear in creative work. That a lot of times when someone doesn't finish, it's fear. And a lot of times when you hit writer's block, it's fear. I still remember these words live in the back of my head. My eighth grade teacher saying to me one day when I was working on an independent project and I came in and I said, I have writer's block. And she said, writer's block is just code word for fear. Write your way through it. And all I want from you is 200 of your most mediocre words available, right? And it sounds really bad, but she was like lowering the standards, right? To help raise the standards. Like she was teaching me that it was okay as this little perfectionist kid to get past that and move past it. And so I'm curious, what do you think are some strategies that can help teachers and students? So if you think about it at the teacher level and the student level, get past the fears that prevent them from getting, you know, turning an idea into a reality.
Okay. So I'm going to talk a little bit about my class because it is kind of a through line of the book and the way we structure whatever activity or whatever theme of the session has this built in, I want to say method that addresses exactly what you're talking about. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I'll get to the method and it's not even like this big secret, but it is, to your point, something you have to condition. So Creative Gym is a class that is a skills based, it's a personal skills based class at the D School at Stanford. It's one of the two longest running classes. I've taught it for about 15 years and about I feel like in 2006, so almost 10 years ago, a brain surgeon came up to me at the end of 10 weeks and said, "Hi, Grace, am I different?" You know, and I'm like, "Of course you're different. You just took 10 weeks of this amazing course. Like you are transformed." And he's like, "No, is my brain different?" And this visiting, I was like, Dr. Daniel Hahn, you are a brain surgeon. You tell me if your brain is different. Like, I'm not the brain expert here. But that query launched this almost decade-long research about creative capacity building. Mm-hmm. And it was based on the activities that we run in class. So I'm going to bury the lead. I'm going to do it in like really quickly, just to cut to the chase. The two questions we were asking in the research was, can you teach creativity? Mm-hmm. And is it acquired knowledge like riding a bicycle? Because like once you know how to ride a bicycle, you forever know how to ride it. Yeah. Or is it like a muscle that you have to condition? So if I have a six pack, because I did a bunch of sit-ups, I'm making that up. Like, can I just be like, yeah, I got this? Or do I need to keep doing sit-ups to maintain my six pack? So the answers are one, yes, you can teach creativity. You can condition your creativity because it is a muscle. So let's say, fine, some people are born stronger than others just by like, you know, like I could be built like a professional NBA athlete or not, right? Like we don't pick our height or our weight or our girth or our strength, but those are things we can train ourselves to become better at. Mm-hmm. So while somebody might be born with a certain creative capacity, let's say this is me and this is you, and you're like, I got this. You're like, I'm creative, right? And I'm like, oh, I'm less creative. Okay, so, right, I can work at it and increase my capacity. Mm-hmm. So in the study, the greatest finding was that the part of the brain that is normally associated with, we thought that would be part of being creative, which is the front of the brain, which is like the thinking part, was actually more quiet in the more highly rated outcomes of our participants. So actually the postdoc, Dr. Manish Shigar, he wrote the article that was published on this finding. And mm-hmm. the takeaway headline is think less, do more, which points to this bias of action, which mm-hmm. is a mindset that is very integrated in how the D school teaches in our pedagogy or whatever you want, like our methods of teaching. So if you're a student in Creative Gym, we open every session with a 60-second warm-up. Mm-hmm. So for example, you come into class. So this is just an example of, there's a piece of black construction paper, right? Mm-hmm. You have 60 seconds using only your hands to transform that piece of construction paper into something that, one, covers your face, still allows you to see, that is hands-free, right? Those are the mm-hmm. three objectives. Mm-hmm. And you have 60 seconds, and I say, go. And you can, what do you think would happen in that classroom, mm-hmm. right? Are people pausing and like, let me think about what I'm going to do, or, hey, what are you doing? Let me see what you're doing, and then I'll start. No, people like dive in, and they have their piece of paper and they're like doing, whoa, like it's like a frenzy, mm-hmm. you know, like Iron Chef. Okay, time's up, hands away from the table. And I'm like, when you're done, hold it up, right? And what's funny is like I say, hold it up and then give it, trade with the person next to you. And everyone's like, oh crap. Like, cause mm-hmm. There's another lesson in that. But when we do, when we have the students repeat over 10 weeks, multiple versions, there's a 60 second, there's a 3 minute. These are levers when you're designing curriculum. So for example, in that example, there was a constraint of material. There was a constraint of time. There was a kind of a constraint of outcome, like a prescribed outcome. Those were all intentional. And you could make it open. You could have the outcome open. You could have the time, longer. I mean, there's so many levers, but that's like going to the gym and having a private trainer say, do this circuit. And you're just like, okay. And you're just like kind of blindly following them, but you're developing a certain muscle mm-hmm. that at the end of the workout, you're like, wow, I feel energized. I feel exhilarated and I don't even know why. And that feels good. And that's what happens when you go to Creative Gym at the D school. Uh-huh. And that's what creates a bias to action, because we continuously push our students through these experiential activities that hone their intuition and creates this bias to action.
I love
and
it.
With that, you lose your fear. You lose your judgment. this piece of paper that was like a silly mask, whatever you want to call it, doesn't matter. It's it's going in the recycling bin after, right? It's low stakes, no failure. Doesn't matter.
I love the bias toward action. And I love the concept that you brought up at the beginning of this, connected to fear, of getting past the notion that there is such thing as a creative type, right? That's it's this cultural myth that's just not true, right? And that we can build creative capacity in everyone. When you think about that particular aspect, and you think about students internalizing that notion, teachers internalizing that notion, what do you recommend for a teacher who says, I want creativity, I value it, I think it's important, I'm just not very creative myself? What's your first thing you would say to that person?
I would say, lose that thought.
Uh-huh.
And maybe I was thinking about this actually recently. So at the D School, we talk about innovators, not innovations.
Mm-hmm.
And as a teacher, you're transforming students. That's why we talk about, it's not about the solution to a problem at the D School. Our job is to transform the student, because in each student, there's infinite solutions, mm-hmm. right? So as a teacher, I would tell that teacher, shift the conversation away from creativity, because it sounds like a thing, like it sounds like a noun, and like either you have it or you don't, or how much it, like how talented are you with, like, let's erase the word creativity and let's reframe it as creator. Like, you are a creator, because teacher, you are a creator. You're creating lesson plans, you're creating a day, you're creating an experience, you're creating so many things on so many different dimensions. And ultimately, you're creating the student, like you're creating the way they think, and you're helping shape that. And I feel like if we tell the students, everybody, we are all creators. And that's kind of the message that I'm trying to get across, is that it's a resource. It's an unlimited resource we all have, and it's ours for the taking. You can have as much of it as you want. You just have to do the work to bring it to yourself, right? That's almost with anything. It takes work. Like, nothing comes to you for free. Like, honestly, nothing.
Yeah.
I feel like that would be a game changer. Like, we are all creators, every one of us, in ways small and large. I don't know. What do you think? Does that sound like digestible, palatable? I don't know.
I think so. I mean, I think for me, as someone who teaches pre-service teachers, I often, I kind of do what my teacher did with me. I make it low risk, lots of tiny low risk moments to engage in something creative, a divergent thinking challenge, a design challenge. Sometimes it's linguistic, sometimes it's visual. When we do sketch noting, for example, for note-taking, simple, but people are terrified of, is my work good enough? I'm not an artist, you'll hear, or I'm not good at drawing.
Yeah.
And so I just say, I don't care if it's good, I care if it's fast. And I'm just saying, like, quality doesn't matter. I want you to get your ideas out quickly. And it's the speed up aspect. And of course there's a side of slowing down, but it's like, I'm not looking for artistic talent. I'm just looking for you to do that. Yeah. And I always tell them that we sometimes confuse experience with expertise. And I said, you're probably better at drawing than you think you are. You're probably worse at driving than you think you are.
Right? Our self-perceptions are totally warped. But you know what? Like, you said the word drawing, and it made me think of this activity that we run literally in the first 10 minutes of the very first session of Creative Gym. And it's not something we invented. It's something that I think one of the famous art schools like do as part of their application process, I heard. But it's called a blind portrait drawing, and you've seen them. And basically, the magic isn't in the actual doing, even though there is magic in that. So what you do is, people have a Sharpie and they have a piece of paper. And let's say you and I are partners and we look at each other. I can't look at the paper two rules. I'm not allowed to look at my paper. I have to keep my eyes on you, and I'm not allowed to lift my pen. And we have like 30 to 60 seconds, however long you want to run it. So you and I are both looking at each other, drawing. Mm-hmm. And at the end, what we do is we line up everybody's drawing on the floor. They look alike. They all look the same. And people are like, oh, like, I mean, there's so much joy and like that experience. And people, like, to your point, because they're not looking down, they can't judge, right? Mm-hmm. They can't look at like, oh my God, the eye's in the wrong place. My nose looks terrible. Like, nobody can do that. But kind of the magic happens, like, is when you see what everybody in the room did and you're like, your picture is as squiggly as mine. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It looks like a hot mess, but I'm telling you, I could frame each and every one of those portraits and put it in a gallery and said, yeah, Picasso did these. And nobody did it. That's how cool they look. So, awesome. But yeah, but that's like, that's a small way of, but this whole notion of like fear of failure, we want to fail early and fail often. That's also a very kind of pervasive thing at the D school. Because if you wait too long into the process to share your work and get feedback, you're so far down line, your failure is larger than if you shared your work earlier and got feedback. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And failure is, it's, if you don't fail, you're definitely not pushing yourself enough. Does that make sense? Like, yeah. Race car drivers, like they like drive to the point of like, they toe that line of like out of control, right? Mm-hmm. To win the race. And I'm not saying like, let's put ourselves in, not in safety or take us ourselves out of safety. I'm just using that as an example. Cause there's like a famous Indra quote, like that says exactly that. Like, if you're not, you know, if you're not out of control, I don't know. It says something to that notion. Like, if you're not feeling scared, you're not driving fast enough. Like, you're not pushing yourself.
So as I hear you describe this, you know, one of the things I'm struck by in all these examples is the concept of like creative constraints, right? And, you know, one of the things I love from design thinking, it comes across sometimes, certainly the D school has explored this before, but the notion that sometimes the constraint is what leads to deeper creative thinking, that often the barrier can be incorporated into the design. Like, I nerd out on baseball stadiums, and my favorite stadiums, the thing that was in the way became the centerpiece of the end result, right? Whether you're thinking about Fenway Park, Camden Yards, you know, Petco mm-hmm. Park. If anyone's listening and they don't love baseball, they're going to be like, that was a horrible example. but you know, you're deliberately creating these barriers, these, whether it's time, limited materials, rules. And yes. I'm curious, where do you see the barrier and the creative constraint fitting into the creative process?
It's almost like if you said to your student, like, you have to turn in a paper in 5 days, right? Versus you have the next 5 months. Do you think they're spending 5 months working on that same paper? Are they waiting at the end to do that paper, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like there's this sense of time, because I think time is a constraint. In terms of the creative process, the constraints that we do intentionally in these experiences or these activities in the classroom, mm-hmm. Sometimes we don't prescribe it. Sometimes it's open. Like, think mm-hmm. of a time that you were disappointed, right? And then like that just opens. I mean, fine. Like, it's couched in disappointment, but like you have, you know, in our case, like 20, 25 years of disappointment to think it through. Right. Mm-hmm. And if you, what I've noticed is if it's too wide, people have an inability to focus. They can focus more mm-hmm. quickly if sky isn't the limit, right? Mm-hmm. And as an entrepreneur, I feel like I deal with that daily. I don't have enough time. I don't have enough resources. I don't have exactly the right people, right? Like, I, you know, because I don't have enough money to hire the best person. So I have to hire like maybe like a very good person, right? And then yeah, it's just like things are rapidly coming at me and I just have to, if I don't like deal with it, it's just going to be behind me. And it's like, it's just behind me. And I can't, I got to just keep going. Like the train keeps going with or without you as an entrepreneur. Like I'm sure you can relate to that.
Yeah.
So they always say, what is it? Necessity is the mother of invention.
Uh-huh.
I think that's cliche for a reason.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I mean, when you think about all the activities that I've described so far, was it a fancy material? No, it was a piece of paper. We make balls out of Post-its. We like whatever. It's very MacGyver. Like, hey, whatever you have laying around, I can create it into an activity. I can, there's a method of teaching that I can, it doesn't have to be high tech. Like, in fact, I'm a huge proponent and torchbearer for the analog. I am. We are human, tangible beings. And we live in a built environment and we need to interact with it in order to solve these problems and interact with each other, like in real life.
Absolutely. So as you think about, you've described this sort of idea of see, start, do, finish. And I'm curious if you could walk people through kind of how that process works.
Okay. So I said in the beginning, there are two things that are standing between us and our possibilities, and it's starting and finishing. And in this book, there's a bunch of tactics, contexts, activities, and workarounds for starting, getting your ideas and linking your ideas to action. Mm-hmm. So you can bring whatever it is that's in your head to fruition, however small, however big. Right. We are all creators. I can't say that enough. And I actually like repeating things because you might not hear it the first time, but it might sink in a little bit the third time. I mean, think as a parent, the more you repeat it, the better, because it's literally lodged in their subconscious. Right. Like one day when the moment arises where they're going to be like, oh, that's what she was talking about. Or like, oh, this is that moment. Right. That mom was talking about. So see, start, do, and finish. Let me try to, I want to do this differently because I can like say, oh, this means that, or see, you want to be able to visualize what it is that you want your outcome to be. It's like setting a goal. I mean, if you don't have a goal, like where are you driving to, right? So you want to set what your destination is, but you also want to be able to see it clearly, because your brain doesn't know the difference between an imagined scenario and a real memory. Does that make sense? I mean, athletes do that all the time. They quietly, you know, see themselves hitting the perfect shot, right? I mean, they do that for that reason. It creates kind of a muscle memory in your brain. Mm-hmm. There's actually an example I point to, which is a phenomenon in driving called target fixation. Kind of like what you look at is where you're going to drive to. So it's kind of a safety mechanism to remember, especially like, okay, so we're in Northern California, you're driving in Tahoe, your car skids out. And when your car slides out in the snow or on an icy road, let's say you're beelining to a tree. Well, if I keep my eyes looking at that tree, I'm most definitely probably going to drive directly in it. But something happens when I avert my gaze back to the road. Like, I don't know if it's by looking at my, you know, when I turn, I turn. I don't know what the phenomenon is. But basically, if you keep your eyes on the tree, you will drive into the tree. If you turn your eyes to the road, you might avert that tree. And that is related to not only visualization, but also your thoughts, right? You want to focus your thoughts on the outcome that you want. So it's like, don't look at the tree. Don't focus. This is for the parents who are educators, who are also parents on the podcast. Like, do not worry. Please don't waste your time on worrying. I tell my mother this very frequently, and it's a hard habit to shake. And it's also human nature.
Yeah.
But when you are worried, you are focusing your energy on negative outcomes that haven't happened yet. So let's all try to just stop doing that, because it's, you don't want to be looking at the tree. You want to look at the road, right? Yeah. So that's kind of seeing and then starting, like starting. There's a lot of stories and tactics. We kind of already addressed a couple of them. We feel a failure. If something feels uncomfortable, we shrink back. And the one thing I want to point to is that we are, as human beings, we are wired for certainty, comfort, and safety, mm-hmm. right? Our prehistoric ancestors, when they saw a bear or a woolly mammoth, they had to run, mm-hmm. right? And for them, that was a matter of life and death. For us today, fear or if something feels uncomfortable or we feel tension, we often step back. Mm-hmm. What's going on? Should I be doing this? Right? It gives us pause. But in reality, that's your body, that's your brain trying to protect you mm-hmm. from discomfort, from safety. But when we visualize that a kite flies at its zenith with the most wind resistant mm-hmm. resistance. When you think about that, like, can you fly kite when it's just kind of breezy? No, you fly when the wind is pounding and it's like, oh, it's hard to fly and it doesn't feel good. But you're like, that's when I can make the kite go as high as it possibly can. And I feel like with that analogy, it's like, you want to lean into the tension. That's like mm-hmm. the driving a little fast. Like if you're comfortable, you're not pushing yourself. And starting is hard. There's never the perfect time. And maybe the task is too big. So I think of ladder, you want to break it up into smaller pieces, mm-hmm. right? Because then they're more achievable. And momentum begets momentum.
Yeah.
Doing is all about execution. Ideas are worthless. I honestly believe that. As I studied film in graduate school as well. And like, everyone's like, oh my God, I'm not telling you my idea. Like, it's so good. You're just like, oh my goodness. Like, until you write that script, that idea is nothing, right?
Yeah.
Nothing. And people forget that they're very protective of their ideas. And I mean, yeah. And I have an example in the book of like, oh my goodness. Like, yeah. Like one idea, there's like infinite executions of that idea. So that's unique to you. So like, don't hold your ideas so closely. And doing like, you just got to show up. How you do everything, do it with your full self. With your full intention, with trying to do a good job, right? Because I'm telling you, when you do things that way, and I tell this to my kids, I am a broken record about this, I will admit, but I want to instill in them, you're spending the time to make your bed, make it fantastically. like, why not? Why do a half-assed job about it? Like, build those habits in yourself and then finishing. I think the most important takeaway in finishing is related to judgment, which is also to, okay, so one, you are your only true judge. And two, there really isn't a finish. Like, think of our lives. Think of like things that you've done and have accomplished to date. Things are just, they're just kind of an ongoing kind of moving, living organism, right? Like, think about podcast. Where did that start? Where's this going to? Like, is your podcast like a finite, boxable project? No, it's got tentacles. It's got a root that stretches over here, and it's got a future that's going to go up here. So I don't know. I feel like I tried to highlight the takeaways, but that is the 4C start, do, and finish that will get you from your idea to the realization of your possibility. And a possibility could just be tonight's dinner. It doesn't have to be save the world. Like, we have multiple possibilities in our lives every moment of our day, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah.
What I love about that is, you know, this podcast is all about creativity in the classroom, right? And that's a broad topic. And some of it is about long-term, big project-based learning, things that are going to take half a semester, right? A long, big, epic project. And then some of it's those tiny little design sprints or that warm-up that you did that sparks divergent thinking or whatever it may be. And what I love about your framework and the way you've thought through it is this works on something that we're going to spend 20 minutes doing. And this works on something that we're going to spend weeks, right? It's true to so many aspects of creative work. And the strategies embedded within that are, again, so adaptable, so transferable.
Yeah. I don't know about you, but, or the educators out there, but like when we're in the classroom, I mean, when you think like, wow, I've taught the same class for 15 years, like you'd think I'd like be phoning it in. I just show up and give them something and I walk away. And it's actually every year, it's like a new experience. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I have the framework for that warm up, but how it's received and what happens next is unfolding every time. Does that make sense? Yeah. And you have to adjust, and it's so fun. That is so fun because think of like the classroom of kids. It's like the composition of who they are they're so different each time. And that's where the gold is mined, right? Like that's where the learning outcomes and the aha moments happen. I feel like honestly is when the peer to peer, like what they see, like when I described, when we lay down those blind portraits, oh my God, everyone's like, oh, wow. Okay. It took that student's experience and it literally made it that much bigger because it made it like exponentially increased that person's processing of that experience by seeing what everybody else did. And then we talk about it. We debrief. What just happened? Who was afraid that they were having a crappy drawing? Uh-huh. Who was surprised by their drawing? Who thought that was the worst activity ever? You know, why? Yeah. Right. And then when people talk about it, like there's a little of everybody in all of us, right? That's the common denominator. And when they experience that, it's like they fear less, they feel more connected, and then they feel more comfortable to take risks.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Is what I found.
So my final question as we kind of wrap it up is, I genuinely believe that if a teacher wants to have a more creative classroom, part of it is focusing on the students, being empathetic to the students, asking what they need. But I also think that creative teachers lead to creative students, that personal creativity is vital, that engaging in creative work in whatever ways it looks like in your own life will impact, it will spill over into your practice as an educator. And so yeah. I'm wondering as a final question, what are some practical things that you would recommend to someone who maybe doesn't feel like they're particularly creative, they value creativity, they want their students to engage in creative work? I'm curious, how can they take that sort of bias toward action that you described and just do small aspects of creative work in their own life? So outside of school, just what would you say, try this, go for this?
Okay, I'm going to answer your question in two parts. One, outside of work, but then two, in work. I'm going to give them an example. And maybe I'll start there because I remember going to an education, like whatever, there's like teaching and learning. There's like a major, like a master's degree in that in Stanford. I went to one of their breakfasts. It was like a showcase. And it was like, there were a couple professors and postdoc students from different departments that were there. And there was this one woman who was a graduate student. And she said, so she's like looking at things in a microscope that are too little to see in the real world, right? Like just with the naked eye, you cannot see what she's looking at. She built life-size models of a certain molecule and tried to figure out what was happening, that what they were seeing under the microscope, but seeing it in real life, like in front of them that they could touch and move, and they solved something by building a molecule, right? I just feel like there's such a great opportunity and lesson in that, in articulating that, because something that like, yeah, fine. It's about the technology of being able to see something that you can't see with your naked eye. That's one dimension and facet of science or biology or whatever it is that they're doing. And then what's happening? What is happening with the cells under the, and they had a question that they couldn't resolve or understand. And then they took it from this dimension, right? Like it is still physical, right? But it's not, they're seeing it through a lens and they made it in a different dimension. And it led to this wonderful outcome. Uh-huh. So I feel like for a math teacher or a science teacher, where you're like, well, that's not art. Like that has nothing to do with that, but it does, right? Uh-huh. Like to have kids experience how to learn something. And I don't know if I said, like, I was an art major who got a CPA. Uh-huh. And I'll tell you, I took an accounting class as an undergrad and I dropped that class because I was not getting a good grade. Yeah. Okay. And then when they hired me, I don't know why they hired me, bless their hearts, because I learned a lot. And it obviously gave me a great foundation to a lot of things. There's no way I could have learned any of that out of a textbook. I had to go into companies and actually audit their books to understand what a debit and a credit and how the income statement ties to a balance sheet. Like that made zero sense to me in text, but in real life, it made sense. So I feel like this outside of a book, outside of the information, how do we activate a concept or whatever, something, it could be so little in a different way. So for personal, like for yourselves, I feel like educators, I feel like they have it hard because they have so many demands, not enough resources, you know, they've got like things coming from them from every which way. So I recognize that. What can we do or you do for yourself that makes you feel like you're creating something, that you're growing? It could be a meal. It could be, I don't know what that is, where you're learning, I feel like you're learning something new. I'm an advocate for making things with your hands, but maybe it's like, maybe it's music. Maybe it's watching a car race. Maybe it's, I don't know, bird watching, whatever it is. If we're not growing, we're dying. And I know like people get sick of their jobs because they're just like, it's like, I have to do this. And there's nothing new. People get excited when there's like new stuff. And new stuff is nurturing your personal growth and your mindset. And you do that by trying new things and doing new things. That's what I think.
I love it.
I don't know if that's helpful. It could be a recipe.
No, that's great. No, I'm with you. That's so great. Well, thank you so much for sharing your time and your insights. And just thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. And you guys, grab a book when you can.
All right, so that is this episode with Grace Hawthorne. I hope you got as much out of it as I did. I really enjoyed my conversation with her. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify or wherever it is that you listen to podcasts, and maybe tell a friend about it as well. So again, subscribe, like, tell someone about it. That would mean the world to me. Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something